You're listening to Messenger Insight, a news and information program brought to you by the Baptist Messenger and the Baptist General Convention of Oklahoma.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Messenger Insight. I am Brian Hobbs, your host, and I am honored to have with us on today's program scholar, essayist, author, research fellow at the Hoover Institution, Mary Eberstadt. Mary, welcome to Messenger Insight.
Thanks very much for having me, Brian.
Now, you've written what I think, and others as well, consider an important book, a very important book called Adam and Eve After the Pill, Paradoxes of the Sexual Revolution. Now, to warn our listeners, we are going to be delving into some weighty issues that might not be appropriate for, of course, people of all ages and children, but it is an important topic nonetheless. Now, you talk in your book about the sexual revolution through the lens of two little words that have forever changed the course of history, and by that I mean the pill. And
Yes. Could
you talk a moment what persuaded you to write this book at this time on this topic?
Well, one thing that persuaded me was that a couple of years ago, as I'm sure you remember, Brian, on the 50th anniversary of the approval of the pill, there was a lot of talk, especially in the secular media, about how wonderful the pill had been for women. It had liberated them from the chains of their fertility, how great it had been for men and families and so on. And I was really struck that there was very little attention to what I would call the dark side of that legacy, the dark side of the legacy of the sexual revolution. And how do we measure that side? Well, after the pill, divorces skyrocketed, broken homes proliferated. Obviously, artificial contraception flooded the sexual marketplace with competition, and that meant that it became harder for people to find enduring relationships. This is part of the argument of the book. In other words, in ways that were not taken into account when people were celebrating the anniversary of the pill, the pill has increased unhappiness in various ways that are measurable by social science. And that's what my book is really about. It's about using perfectly secular sources to say, look, there's a lot of evidence out there to suggest that this stuff has not been a great thing for humanity, that we need to take a second look at the sexual revolution and get an honest estimate of what the damage is out there.
Absolutely. And what I appreciated so much was that you did not expect the reader necessarily to come from a Roman Catholic perspective. You were talking to people of goodwill and good sense who are willing to step back and look at the honest evidence, and what does that evidence point to? And I liked your format, how you talked about its effect on women, its effect on men, children, the university level, and so much of what you said speaks to the heart of it, which was this was painted and promoted as a good thing for women, and your findings have shown the exact opposite?
Well, yes, let's talk for a minute about the campus, because as a mother, that's something that I think about quite a lot. There's a lot of evidence out there, Brian, to suggest that American campuses, and I mean all campuses, are places where women are at increased risk for sexual assault. There is a study commissioned by the United States Department of Justice that I quote in my book, which estimates, based on many thousands of young women surveying themselves, that one in four or one in five young women is the victim of sexual assault, typically during her first or second year on campus.
Oh, wow.
Now, even if you say, look, it's a situation of he said, she said, and we can't be sure what's really happening there, still, those numbers are just wildly disproportionate to what anybody wants to send their daughter into. Again, I link this outcome to the sexual revolution because the atmosphere on many campuses, as you know and all of your listeners know, is very anything goes these days, and there's nobody in authority. And the idea is that, you know, sexual conduct is this personal matter that doesn't affect anything else. Well, I say when you read those sexual assault statistics, you have a public problem. This is not just a problem of personal conduct.
Indeed. And your book also points to the research that has borne this out in a sad story. Now, you also make mention of the fact that we have removed, through use of the pill, the consequences of the action from the act. And by that, you talk about this idea of sterile sex and what that has done to women, what that has done to men. And we've created almost a barbarian's paradise in some cases, whereby men are no longer held accountable for their actions in part in the Sexual Relations Act.
What? Yes, and to get there, you just need to read what women are saying when they think they're talking among themselves. And I take the example of a number of articles in prominent magazines, you know, women arguing about things like, well, maybe marriage is over, or it's impossible to find a good man, or I need to strike out on my own and have a child on my own because I can't find anybody reliable to be my life partner. These sad stories, again, are consequences of the sexual revolution, and it's very meaningful that they're coming from people who would defend that revolution. I'm talking about, you know, secular magazine writers in places like the Atlantic Monthly and Time and places like that. So they don't understand themselves quite what's happening there, and that's why I really wanted to put out a big picture for people to contemplate as we think about what these past decades of the sexual revolution has really wrought.
Who are the composite scenarios in the book, Betty and Jennifer, and what do they represent?
Those are two characters I invented to drive home a point. Betty is an imaginary housewife from the 1950s, and Jennifer is her imaginary granddaughter today. And my point is this. Back in Betty's time, people had a pretty secure public consensus about sexual matters. The Judeo-Christian ethic was pretty much what people accepted. That is to say, they thought that in sex there were matters of right and wrong. And at the same time, about matters of food, they didn't attach morality to it. You can't find writing from that time about the rights and wrongs of, you know, eating local or going green or eating organic or any of the things we have now. Betty's granddaughter, Jennifer, is completely the opposite. If she is a typical woman of her time, she's going to imbibe the secular message that sex is a private matter and it's not a matter of right and wrong as long as there are consenting adults involved. But at the same time, she's likely to have all kinds of moral feelings about food, that there are rights and wrongs about, you know, which kind of tuna fish to buy and all the sorts of things that you read about, especially young people having preoccupations about. So my point is that something really weird has happened since the sexual revolution. It's as if people have stopped being moral about sex, but they've started being moral about food instead. And I argue that these things are related.
I thought that was a great point and very eye-opening and reminded me of C.S. Lewis, who in his Screwtape Letters mentioned that the devil loves it when people are running around with fire hydrants during a flood. And in your book, you point out that we're worked up about just the sort of thing that we should not be, and we are not worked up about the things we ought to. And you go way out of your way to document, as you said, some of the secular headlines, the way people are thinking. But you conclude the book by talking about the vindication of humana vitae. And for our Protestant and evangelical listeners who might not be familiar with that document, could you explain what that is and its significance to this overall discussion?
Yes, of course. It was a papal document issued in 1968. And even if you don't recognize the Latin, you've surely heard of the document because it's probably the most reviled document in the modern religious world. It's the document that reiterated traditional Christian teaching against the use of artificial contraception. And everybody knows that in the secular universe, nobody has more fun with anything than making fun of humanae vitae and the idea of a ban on artificial contraception. Well, the reason I find this really interesting is that a few years ago, I actually read the document. I had not read it before, and I was really impressed. Dramatically impressed with how much truth was in that document. And what I mean is this. That document looks at the modern world and says, you know, this sexual revolution is going to lead to a lot of problems. The document predicts, for example, that oppressive governments will use these artificial contraception technologies in a coercive way, and this has certainly happened. Look at China. Look at other examples that I give in the book. This all came true after the document was issued. The document says, in a world where artificial contraception is everywhere, men are going to have less respect for women, and there's going to be more trouble between the sexes than there was before. Again, this came true. It predicts home breakups. Again, this came true. Now, I'm not saying it's a prophecy. What I'm saying is that document is a pretty good blueprint to what the world looks like today. And yet, no one, very few people, will give the document credit for seeing the world as it is and for understanding what the sexual revolution was going to do to it. There's a great paradox here, Brian. It's that there's a lot of resistance, obviously, to getting out any bad word about the sexual revolution. And the reason that I have all those sources in the book is that I wanted to really put the evidence in one place and say, let's contemplate this.
Yes, and I thought you did a very eloquent job of bringing together these resources, of talking about the prophetic voice that document had and how the consequences are being echoed out day by day. And the book is called Adam and Eve After the Pill, Paradoxes of the Sexual Revolution. They say the unexamined life is not worth living. And I think any thinking Christian out there or person of goodwill ought to get a copy of this book and ponder what God is calling them to do in terms of this issue of sexuality as it relates to the pill, but society-wide as well. Mary, thank you for writing this. Thank you for defending the values and virtues contained within the faith, for calling men to a higher way in the way we treat women and the way we view these bodies God has given us. And I just want to wish blessings upon you. And I hope this book makes the impact that we know it will.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's a wonderful interview. I really appreciate it.
Blessings to you. And I want to contend all our listeners should go online and order a copy or go to your local bookstore. Again, we've been talking to Mary Eberstadt, who is an author, essayist, scholar, and a leading opinion leader in society today. Thank you again.
Thank you, Brian.
You have been listening to Messenger Insight, brought to you by the Cooperative Program and the Baptist General Convention of Oklahoma. For more, find us in the iTunes Store or visit us at BaptistMessenger.com.